You okay, Rina? You seem stressed. What's going on?
Do you ever feel that parenting a disabled child is chaos, like absolute paperwork chaos? There's just so much admin on top of caring for your kids. It's like I'm my freaking daughter's PA.
Ah, yes. You should try the new Hibi app.
An app?
Not just any app, it's Disabled Parenting Mega PA organization. So you can schedule appointments, have reminders for your medication, have all of their medical notes and letters in just one place.
Hang on, spell this out to me again.
Hibi, Hibi. It's a disabled parenting organization app. I wish I'd had it when B was younger. It gives me a sense of control over, well, the uncontrollable.
Sounds intriguing. Who doesn't want to organize disabled parenting chaos one notification at a time?
Haha, yes, it's my new sidekick. Sidekicking the shit out of disabled parenting organization.
That's the least catchy strapline I've ever heard, Lauren.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. They won't want it. But if you, like Rena and I, want to give it a go, you can download Hibi for free on the App Store now. In this episode of Fucking Normal, we talked with Nicole Stevens all about well-being.
Oh, that was such a lovely episode. Really enjoyed talking to her.
Yeah, she was gorgeous and had such great ideas and insights and tips on how to look after yourself as a SEM parent. I've definitely learned something.
100%. I think I also learned what I have been doing wrong.
What have you been doing wrong? Nutritionist by qualification, Rena. What have you been doing wrong?
Eating my feelings.
Ah!
No, I think I've realized that when I have a bad day, I like a slice of cake. If I leave the house, I need a treat because I've made it through the day. But then when it becomes a routine is when it becomes a problem.
Oh my God, you're making me hungry. I really want to go get a Baby Bell out the fridge now.
Having said that, I think I've got some Baby Bell too, actually.
A total treat for me. Like, what can I find in the fridge that's just like a treat? Because I deserve it. Yeah, I definitely have that too.
Oh no, it's terrible, but I'm slowly getting better. Not to say that I still don't have cake every other day, but still.
Well, let them eat cake. No, that's a really naff joke. The thing I am getting better at is leaving my phone like away from me. At first, you get that panic. But then actually, I find in the evenings, if I just leave it charging somewhere else, it's quite nice. It's quite freeing and clearly good for you. So that's something I'm trying to do that's in my self-care bucket, if I can put it like that.
Oh, that's such a good idea. I don't think I have the willpower to not have my phone next to me, but that's a good idea. We say we need to take on what Nicole's been telling us.
It's not me first, it's me too.
Yes, so lovely. I love that. And I have to remember to think like that because I think lots of people think that self-care is so selfish when actually it really isn't, especially when you have a SEN kid. Like, how are you expected to look after your child with all these additional needs if you aren't looking after yourself?
Yeah, I really hope everybody enjoys the episode. This is the Fucking Normal podcast, the cheers, tears, and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway?
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
Welcome back to the Fucking Normal Podcast. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Rena.
Our guest today is Nicole Stevens. Nicole is mum to 11-year-old Amber and 6-year-old Skye. She lives in West London with the girls and her husband, Tyrone. Amber has a genetic condition called DDX3X syndrome. Gosh, just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? The syndrome mainly affects girls who typically present with learning disabilities, low muscle tone, and feeding and speech and language difficulties. Some also have ADHD or are autistic. It was first identified in 2015, and Amber was diagnosed not long after in 2017. These days, the biggest impact for Amber of DDX3X is on her speech and communication, and she has severe learning difficulties. Nicole works in health and nutrition and has worked in the NHS for over 21 years. Welcome, Nicole. It's so lovely to talk to you. Just to kick us off, can you tell us a bit more about Amber? Tell us a bit more about your family as a whole.
Yeah, sure. Hi. Nice to be here. Really excited, but also equally nervous.
No
Don't
need,
be.
no need.
So I am, like you said, I'm Nicole. I am mum to Amber. Amber is 11 and she has got that, super catchy genetic condition called DDX3X syndrome, which means that she has got severe learning disabilities. Mostly affecting her speech and language communication now, but this is over, this is where we are today at 11, but it had significant impact on her development when she was younger. And I became super familiar with terms like global developmental delay, which I had no knowledge of prior to having Amber. And yeah, generally, disabilities aside, the kid is amazing. Like, honestly, I am biased, but I literally beam because everybody agrees with me. And I
Yeah.
get all the time that she is just like joy personified. I pick her up from school, but she's at secondary school now, and I pick her up every day. And it's almost like she hasn't seen me in the morning. She like runs out, gives me a big, massive hug. Like, we haven't seen each other for years.
Oh my gosh, it's
Oh,
gorgeous.
she's gorgeous. She is full of love, full of joy, a really happy being. She's just a happy kid. So, Skye is six. Skye is equally gorgeous and wonderful. She has no disabilities and is typically developing. So I suppose my parenting experience with both of them has been really quite different. And then also the addedness of parenting two children sort of increased the chaos and madness at home. But yeah, she is amazing. She's in year two. She's gorgeous. I remember being pregnant with Skye, and we found out the gender of our kids. Husband was desperate for a boy. I don't know. It's not like we're not in the 1930s anymore. But he really wanted a boy. So missed first time round, obviously, because we got Amber. Missed second time round because I was pregnant with Skye, and he didn't. He wasn't with me when we had that sort of gender scan whenever it was. And I think I found out earlier as well with Skye because there was had been these issues with Amber, and I was super anxious. Do we have a boy or a girl? And I was like, we have a girl. And he was kind of like audibly like disappointed.
Oh no, that's awful.
And then kind of I could hear almost like his internal monologue going, and then he sort of went, do you know what, we needed to have another girl for Amber because she is going to be the person that will look after, not look after Amber in that sense, but in a way that sisters do. That kind of reflection from Tyrone at the time did kind of make me realize as well that, gosh, yeah, Skye's gonna kind of look out for Amber in a way that sisters do generally anyway. It was just a nice sort of package that, he sort of reminded us that it was it, a girl. Because I said, I'm doing two and that's it. You'll have to find somebody else. I'm doing it again.
Oh my God, that's so sweet. What about you? Give us the deets. What was your career? Pre-babies, post-babies?
So I am
42, nearly 43. I'm West London born and bred. I love old school R&B and garage. Like I am a proper, I was an old school raver.
Yes.
It's still in my mind, I still feel like that is me, but my body tells me, no, that is not you. So I could probably manage a day party now or a brunch, maybe once or twice a year.
Brunch.
Which I still love, which I still love. My parents are from the Caribbean. They are currently there now and will be there.
Oh, lucky.
I was
Lucky them. Yeah.
my mum last night, I was like, it's minus four. They'll be there for the next 4 or 5 months. That is like half my support network gone. I am married to Tyrone. We've been together for 22 years, I think. I studied nutrition and health at university. So when I
I
listened to
don't know.
previous podcasts, and I was like, oh, we've got like the shared thing. You did nutrition, right?
I did human nutrition at uni before it was a thing, before I
Yeah.
even knew what it was.
Yeah, same. Well, I did nutrition and health many moons ago. And I think, growing up when I was younger, I was always really, really interested in food. I then became really interested in food from a sort of healing and wellness perspective. I like eating it, but I also just, it's so powerful. Anyway, so I did nutrition and health at university many, many moons ago, and then went into working in the NHS, and I've been there, it's 21 years, and I think it's almost probably pretty much to the day.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Happy anniversary. Workiversary.
And I've always worked within the field of public health nutrition or health improvement or health promotion in the NHS. And I currently kind of oversee one of the children's services in West London. So
Amazing.
with
that kind of health, well-being, NHS, I guess, background, one might think that you were well positioned to, not that anyone could be really positioned for, the less typical parent journey when you're not expecting it. But how did you cope when kind of Amber got her diagnosis?
I got pregnant with Amber a couple of years after being married, and we were both super excited. We had those first scans, it's at 12 weeks, right? And the hospital that I was at somehow managed to mix up my bloods or something went a little bit wrong. So I had to go back and have them done again. And those bloods came back indicating that there was a high risk of having a baby with Down syndrome. So we decided we were going to have the procedure.
Amniocentesis.
It came back that we
Clear.
weren't. It came back clear. So progressed with the pregnancy as usual. When I look back now, I did have extra scans, but the pregnancy was normal. I think you mentioned like having a gut feeling. I remember being before the 12-week scan, I remember waking up one night almost inconsolable. I just was struck with this panic that something wasn't right, that there was something wrong. And I remember Tyron saying, well, what's the matter? Why, it's like early hours in the morning and I was crying, and he said, what, what's the matter? And I was like, I just feel like there's something wrong. And he was like, nothing's, there's nothing wrong. Do you feel like, are you feeling okay? And I was like, I feel fine, but I just feel like there's something wrong. And he was like, let's not call that sort of thing in, like, there's nothing wrong, just go back to sleep. And I couldn't. I got up and I sat in the living room. But that feeling, it was as quickly as it came on, it disappeared. And for the rest of my pregnancy, it was easy breezy. I loved being pregnant. Amber was massively overdue. She was a super colicky baby, like she just, and she wouldn't settle. She didn't settle very easily. So I am super versed in sleep deprivation. There would be some time, I remember, I think I'd probably been up 24, 48 hours with her on occasion.
God.
And what became apparent later on down the line is that it was more than like she was slightly aspirating throughout that time, and we just didn't know. So Lauren, you asked whether or not I suppose my background in the NHS and health kind of equipped me for it didn't. And when I look back on that time as a new mum, although I had no measure, none of my friends at the time had babies. I was the first one in my group. I didn't have any of the children. I didn't really know what was normal or what wasn't normal. And I was going to some of these groups, and yeah, she probably wasn't doing all the things that the other babies were doing at that time. And so it wasn't until she was probably about 3, 4 months that we started to see that there were some sort of de there were delays, there were milestones that were being missed, right? And then that just then became a flurry of appointments, investigations. And at the time, I remember again being really, really anxious and just Googling the shit out of any and everything. I would put in, well, my baby doesn't sit up, my baby doesn't roll over, what does this mean? And things would come up, and I had a list of query, medical conditions that I thought that maybe Amber would have. And I remember speaking to my health visitor, and she said, "You know what, we're going to refer you to the hospital to have the paediatrician kind of look at Amber." And I went in with my list, and he took one look at me and was just like, "This is a neurotic mum, a neurotic first-time mum." And he went, "No, her," he used these words, "her development's adequate." And I thought, "Oh, okay, adequate sounds good to me. Okay." And it was really funny because that same week, my health visitor had also made a referral to the community paediatrics department. And I got a phone call. I think my appointment at the hospital had been on the Monday. I had a phone call on the Wednesday from the community service, and they said, "Oh, do you want to come in? We've had a referral. We've got an appointment on Friday. Can you come in this Friday?" And I said, "Oh, no, I've seen the hospital doctor, and he said that, Amber's fine." And she went, "Do you know what? Just come in anyway. There's no harm in us also taking a look." And I went, "Okay, for sure." So off I popped in, and by this time Amber was about 6 months old, and she asked me loads of questions. She observed, and there was also a physiotherapist in the assessment as well. They did an assessment which took about an hour and a half. And at the end of that, the paediatrician said, "Amber's development is probably half her chronological age. So she's got at the developmental stage of a 3-month-old, and at this point she was 6 months. Right, we are going to run a whole host of tests." And immediately I went into, oh my goodness, like panic mode. She had brain scans, she had blood tests. We were at Great Ormond Street Hospital. I thought she was going to die. That's what I thought, that whatever they were going to find meant that my Amber wasn't going to be with me forever. And I think that stayed with me for a long, long time.
Did you voice that to anyone? No.
No, I didn't. And I also carried with me that I'd done something wrong.
Oh, God.
Was just like, I'd internalized that there must have been something I'd done during my pregnancy. Maybe I didn't take my vitamins in time. Maybe it was that like small glass of wine that I had before I knew I was pregnant. Maybe it was the blue cheese I ate on some cheese. It was all of these things that I just was like, I've done something that's fucked her up, basically.
I think I mean, both Rena and I are nodding furiously here because I think I don't can't speak for everybody, but I've certainly heard from an awful lot of parent carers that, and especially mothers, that they go through that. That I remember having a dinner with my husband, like in the early days, like on a rare occasion that we'd got out, where I sort of confessed to him. It was my fault. I'd done something, and then he said he thought it was his fault. And then we had like this little blubbing moment in a restaurant where we confessed this to each other. But
Did you, because I, it's like hearing myself talk, so thank you. For me, I felt exactly the same, but I also, because I also thought, oh, she's gonna die, like any given time. Plus, because she wasn't breathing and she was on machines, blah, 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 added to that pressure. But also, that self-preservation for me kicked in, where I just wouldn't allow myself to get too attached to her because I didn't actually know how long she was gonna be around for. So then I didn't actually realize that I was doing it until much later, where like she came home. I think it was like 2-3 years after I'd given birth to her that I felt attached to my child, because for that long I was like, if she dies and I've fallen madly in love with you, and I will be absolutely heartbroken, so I would rather keep you at arm's length. I mean, you're my daughter and you're my kid, of course I love you, but it's, I don't want to create that form of attachment, because I just didn't know. Did you do that, or were you like just head over heels? Or
I think that listening to you, Eve, you know, it's an experience that I've heard it loads and loads of times. I was completely opposite. Mm. I was like, right, she is going to be my everything from now on, just in case. And she was also very clingy baby. I would carry her a lot. I went completely the opposite. I was just like, right, and nobody had ever said that she was going to die. I just...
No one said she was going to die to me either, but...
Yeah, I just made it, just, it was a thing in my head, and I was like, right, you know, what if, and just in case, I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to make the most of however... The time.
Yeah.
So I was completely the opposite, and I think that was also a little bit of... Is it added pressure? Added pressure on myself to be this amazing mum, this super caring mum. I didn't really let anybody else look after her, really. You know, like, I just really took that responsibility on. I took her to all the appointments, partly because, you know, also my husband's job didn't really allow for just, you know, a day off. My job was more flexible. And I say flexible, I use that term loosely. And we'll leave to, you know, to take her to these appointments.
Also, you're expected to, because you're the woman and you're the mum, so.
100% that. So it was all of these appointments, and yeah, it was a hard few years. And I can't remember if I've said this already, but I just feel like I survived. I was in survival mode.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I mean, there was moments of absolute joy and pleasure. And I loved being a mum, and it was amazing. But I was also very much just surviving and getting through all those appointments and looking after her. And then, you know, you're not just mum, but then, you know, physio give you all of these exercises that you've got to do at home. So I was doing those at home as well. I was making sure that nursery were doing them when she started nursery. I was doing speech, you know, all these interventions. I was trying to get resources. You know, it's just extra. There's all these extra things that I was doing to help support her development or her progress, or yeah, it was tough going. And
did it change when she got her, did that way of coping change at all after she got her diagnosis? Or
so we spent a long time arming and ahhing about whether or not we would have another child, based on the fact that up until, you know, 2017, we didn't have a diagnosis for Amber. The paediatrician said, right, we can actually enter you into one of two really large studies that may or may not bring a diagnosis for Amber. We discussed it, and again, Tyrone was kind of like, we should do it, but, you know, ultimately it doesn't change Amber. A diagnosis doesn't change who she is. It doesn't change anything. And also, all the health professionals had said that it's unlikely that this is a hereditary condition that would be passed on to any other children. And by then, we decided that we were going to try for another baby. I had Sky in 2017. We got a letter a few months after Sky was born to say, look, we think we may have found the cause of Amber's delays. Do you want to, you know, there's an appointment for you. And the appointment was something like 3 months away.
Ouch. God.
I remember saying to my friend, you know, we've got this letter. They think they found out the cause of Amber's global developmental delay. And she was like, oh my God, like, when's your appointment? We were pregnant at the same time. That's how I met her. She's like, when's your appointment? I told her it was like February of the 2018 or something. She was like, February? Oh my God, like, how are you going to wait that long? And I was like, to be honest, like, it makes no difference. We've been waiting all of these years anyway, like, waiting a few more months. It's neither here nor there to me. We got the diagnosis. I remember sitting in that geneticist's room and I burst into tears. And she said, what's the matter? You know, what's the matter? Why are you crying? And I said, I just thought this was my fault. And that's the first time I'd said those words. And I went, what? And I went, I just thought it was me. And he was like, you didn't say anything. Anyway. So in that consultation, the paediatrician gave us a, you know, there was very little known about the condition. There is still relatively little information about the condition. She gave us this leaflet that an organisation called RARE, I think they're called RARE, had produced, which had findings or sort of insights from this small collection of parents whose girls had been diagnosed with this condition. And I read through that and I was like, my days, this is Amber. This is literally all of these girls. Like Amber, the girls are all generally happy and joyful by nature. Sleep, they were never able to self-settle. That was something we had battled with for years. I hope my mum won't mind me saying this. She's, you know, she raised us in the early 80s, and cry it out was the way that you taught your children to self-settle, and so that's what she knew. And she was like, you just got to leave her to cry, she'll settle herself. And she just never did, and it was heartbreaking and it was hard. And I remember one occasion we moved back into this borough, and before we moved to where we live now, we lived with my mum and dad for a little bit, and my mum looked after her. Tyrone and I had gone to a wedding, and I came back and I said, oh, how was Amber? Did she sleep okay? I think, oh, no, that's it. I think I'd ask my sister to come over to help look after Amber. And they said, oh, yeah, she took a little while to settle down. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, oh, we left her in the cot. She was crying for about 45 minutes an hour. I was like, what?
Oh.
Can't do that. We can't. That's not what we do. Mom was like, well, she's not going to learn to sleep if you don't do it. And so sort of reading that really sort of helped to validate some of my experiences that I'd had with
Amber,
that I just suppose didn't realize had been part and parcel of her condition, had been part and parcel of making some of the parenting more challenging. And I had probably just thought it was me not doing it right.
How was your, like, because obviously being a first time mum, like, there's all that, like, sleep deprivation and all of that. How did, then you've got the added pressure of, like, now having a child with a disability. How were you feeling in that time? Because it's one side, like, being a new mum has all of its hormonal things going on, but then adding this to the pact. What was going through your head? How were you surviving? Did you have help? I struggled personally with, like, accepting the disability and then having my wider circle who are quite traditional and have a backwards way of looking at disability, which then impacted how I saw it. So that added to the mix. What was it like for you?
So I had very little knowledge or understanding or experience of parenting. Like I said, I was the first one out of my friends to have a kid, let alone a kid with disability. I didn't know anybody with a disability. I didn't. I never, none of the groups I went to, there weren't any kids like Amber there. I suppose my family just, we all just, you know, Amber's just Amber. She was accepted. She kind of, you know, I have had comments, not from my immediate family, but I have had comments like, oh, you know, she'll grow out, you know, she'll grow out of it, that sort of thing. I have been told, not again by my family, but like people in my extended network, you know, I'm from a Caribbean background, and culturally, you know, and you know, there's a strong emphasis on sometimes like church and prayer, and you know, maybe you didn't pray enough. And I was like, that's not how this works. Well, at least I don't think it is. So it was, you know, that was really challenging. But I'm really grateful that that didn't come from my family. So, you know, my family just were really supportive and helped as much as they could in the way that they thought they could.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, painted on this facade of everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And yes, Amber has these disabilities or these delays, because they were just delayed, you know, it was global developmental delays at the time, but oh, you know, it's easy breezy. I'm amazing, I'm breezing through this.
But really, what was your well-being like in that moment?
Exhausted, I was overwhelmed, I was surviving on the full fat Coca-Cola and coffee, and I was back at work. I was tired. I was really, really tired. And there would be some times where, you know, I would have two or three appointments in the same week. And now understand that I was having to relive that traumatic experience of having to retell my story over and over again. And there would be sometimes I would come home and that, you know, at this point, you know, I'd come home and I'd sit on the sofa and I would just be like, nobody fucking talked to me for 20 minutes. And they'd be like, you know, are you okay? What can we do? And I'd be like, I just don't want to talk. And, you know, it was, that was the only way that I could, I suppose, process some of the stuff that I'd had to have gone through in those, you know, in a short period of time, if I'd had back-to-back appointments. And then just sort of, I would just sort of bounce back and just go back to being like, everything's fine. I've spoken to friends now who have got children with disabilities, and they have spoken about almost like a grieving process of grieving the child that they thought that they would have. And I must admit that that is not something that I feel like happened with me. And I wonder whether it's because I just went into this, you know, it might come later, but I just threw myself into everything's fine and we'll just keep going.
How would you define your well-being at the time then?
I didn't think about it, to be honest. And at the time, when I look back on it, again, I was very much in survival mode. And I was, the coping strategies I had were probably they were having a detrimental impact on my physical health, which I can come on to a little bit later. But I just, I didn't even think about my well-being at that time. It wasn't a priority. It wasn't something that I acknowledged was a priority. It wasn't a priority. It wasn't a priority.
Yeah.
I was just trying to get through all of these appointments, get to work, keep the kid alive, and let everybody out, you know, present the image of being fine and coping.
Was there like a turning point?
Yeah, there's been a few times, because I default back into perfectionism. Like, it's a curse, right? And I call myself a recovering perfectionist, because I lapse. and I need constant reminders, and those reminders are sometimes quite brutal, and I generally can go for quite a long time just with my head in the sand and just carrying on like normal. And to be honest with you, I did that with Amber for years, and I was almost wearing that, I was exhausted, and I was probably wearing that exhaustion as a badge of honor. Look at me, I'm so tired.
Why do we do that?
All of these things, look at me, aren't I great? Nothing to see here. I am coping with me, my, you know, disabled child, which is fine, you don't need to pity us. Look, do I look like I'm struggling? It was just this image that I was portraying, that everything was okay and everything was fine. And then, and like I said, there's been a couple of times more recently over the last few years, I've had real moments where I've sort of been really forced to look at my well-being and take stock of that bad habit of trying to be perfect all of the time. The first one that I can really talk to is after I had Sky. So like I said, it's quite a, you know, Amber was four, nearly five when I had Sky. So I'd been doing this for 4 or 5 years as a mum. had Sky and wasn't getting that much sleep. So again, just went into sort of that default, lots of caffeine. Actually, it wasn't even caffeine anymore. I'd upgraded to lots of wine.
I love that.
At this time, Tyrone was also working on a Saturday, DJing. So he would come home like really, really late. And I would think of that time as me time. I thought this was me time. I thought this was me looking after myself and doing self-care. I would sit in this spot on the sofa. The table that I've got my laptop on now was my little wine and snacks table. And once the kids had gone down, I was like, right, I'm going to have two or three glasses of wine. I was drinking very little water. I was getting very little sleep and I was doing nothing in terms of physical activity. Mm-hmm. And I did, that was self-care for about a year or two after Sky was, for about a year after Sky was born. And then I started to get episodes where I just felt very unwell. Like I felt tired to my bones in a way that I had never felt tired before. And I kept getting ill, like just infections, colds. And I remember going to the doctor and saying, I just don't feel that well.
Mm.
And she was like, oh, that, you know, let's run some bloods. Came back pre-diabetic.
Wow.
And that was like a wake up call for me that actually I'm not looking after myself. And if I do not look after myself, then this is now going to be, I'm on a downward trajectory.
Yeah.
Did anybody around you at the time kind of signal to you that they felt that you weren't looking after yourself or that you needed more rest or anything? Or was that, were you kind of just oblivious to that?
My mum does all of the time. She was doing it at the time. She still does it now. And I just ignore her.
It is really hard to hear from other people. And I think what we do sometimes hear from other people, though, is the stuff that reinforces it. So, you know, earlier you were talking about, you know, as women, or as parents, as mothers, we often just go into that, like, I'm going to be amazing at this and the best at this. And just like, I can handle everything, more, more, more. And I do think, find that sometimes you get this kind of negative reinforcement that is people saying like, oh, I don't know how you do it. You're doing another thing. Oh, you're managing all of these things. And it's like this, you sort of command this respect for being like tired to the bone, as you put it, by managing all of these things. And it's really destructive. Why do we do that to each other to kind of give that respect? And not that we should respect each other, but kind of, yeah, validating that that's the way that you should be doing it, when actually, as you've described, you need to look after yourself.
Yeah, that was like the first real kind of wake-up call that I needed to be better at looking after myself.
Mm.
So what did you change? Like, so what were the steps that you took to then change your lifestyle, change the way that you were doing things, making time for yourself?
Help.
I don't know. I'm still not winning at it. So my advice is only coming from a place of these are the things I've tried. And these are the things that work for me. At the time, I was like, right, I'd started doing my local park run on a Saturday morning. So I would leave the kids with Tyrone. I would go and do my 5K and think I was going to die at any moment in time around the 5K course. And I did that for a long time. I just started making sure I was drinking more water, just really basic things that I knew that I should have been doing.
Mm.
My professional background.
That's what I was going to say. Did you revert to your professional hat and be like, if this was a client, this is what I would tell her to do?
Yeah, exactly. And also just from a like a behavior change perspective, I was really realistic in what I could manage around my family and my situation. So that's not me signing up to a gym that I probably will never, ever go to just because I have to do it when somebody else can look after the kids. I can't just call a babysitter and say, oh, could you pop over and look after the kids for a few hours while I go to the gym? It really has to be something that works within us. And like I think I said earlier, you know, I was really, up until, again, fairly recently, you know, I wouldn't let other people look after Amber, really. My mum and my dad and my sibling, my brother and my sister, that's it. You know, outside of our immediate home. So it just made things like that, it just made wellbeing practices that involved me being outside of the home or outside of the home for extended periods of time more challenging.
So what does your wellbeing bucket look like now? What are the things that you do to get you to a place where you're feeling good and you're able to be there for Sky and Amber and Tyrone and just live your life to the best of your ability?
You asked me earlier, you know, if there was anybody who had kind of been saying, you know, slow down, you know, take a minute, you know, what's going on. My mum has always done that, but in 2020 pandemic year, again, I'd gotten to almost breaking point, and Amazon man came to my house and told me, oh, have you ordered something again? I thought, shit, have I ordered something again? I know I order lots of stuff, and I was like, I can't remember if I ordered something. And my gorgeous best friend had sent me a copy of this book called Tender, The Imperfect Art of Caring. It's by a lady called Penny Winter. And I read this book and it really sort of changed my whole understanding of parenting a child with a disability and being a carer. There's a chapter in there on self-care. And again, that was really transformational for me reading through that chapter. And I draw on a lot of the insights from, she talks to a lot of people who are carers, whether they be parent carers or caring for elderly parents or caring for partners. And one of the people that she spoke to in the book is a lady called Susie Redding. I now follow her on Instagram, and I bought probably all of her books, and her favorite, my favorite one, this little book of self-care. And the reason why I love this one is because I don't have the energy, the time, the brain space to have these elaborate self-care practices. And this book has got things in there that I draw on all the time and that I can fit realistically into my day. So when you ask me like the things that are in my bucket, I build in things that, you know, I think in the book she refers to them as micro moments. I refer to them as like micro moments of joy and calm. And they are things that I can squeeze into my day in the matter of maybe 5 or 10 minutes, that just allow me to sit. Maybe sometimes I do this in my garden. I go and sit in the garden with a cup of tea. I leave my phone, laptop, whatever. I pause from work. I sit in the garden and I do nothing. I think of nothing. Even if thoughts pop into my head, I just let them go by. I'm not going to think, oh God, like that thing that I needed to do, I'm just not going to do it. And I try and do that for 10, 15 minutes. It just gives me that time and space away to kind of be still and breathe. And when I started to do that, what it also enabled me to do in that stillness is really listen to my body and think, actually, do you know what? I am tired. And I'm going to, instead of responding to that by drinking more coffee, I'm going to respond to that by trying to have some more rest. Or get some early nights in. And you know, there's loads of things that I've now sort of learned and understand more from a well-being perspective, even outside of my, you know, background in nutrition and health, just really practical things like the importance of sleep. And sometimes my sleep is broken. Amber gets up in the night probably 4 times a week. So my sleep is always getting broken. I can't control that. But what I can do is make sure that when I can, I'll try and catch up. So sleep, I didn't know this, right? Rest has an accumulative effect. So the benefits of sleep and rest build up over time. So even if you can't, even if you're not getting whatever it is that, you know, the 8 hours of sleep a night, if you can get rest where you can, that's readdressing that sleep deprivation. It's topping that, it's redressing that imbalance. And sometimes that just looks like me resting on the sofa. I do yoga nidra.
I love yoga nidra. Oh my God, it's amazing. Do you want to explain what it is?
Yes, I've never heard.
In the pandemic, when everything moved onto Zoom, one of our local organizations, it's like Contact a Family in the borough that I live in, set up these yoga nidra sessions, virtual sessions. And I was like, oh, I do like a bit of yoga. I'm going to do this. It was on a Wednesday night. I got my yoga mat out and then logged onto the Zoom. And the wonderful teacher took us through what I could only describe as a de-relaxation practice. So there was no, I was like ready to do stretches and positions and poses. No, she said, lie down, get yourself comfortable. And she used to say, this is the practice, yoga nidra is the practice of doing nothing. And she would take you through this beautiful guided meditation where she almost kind of encourages you to do this sort of body scan and relax every single part of your body. I must admit though, Lauren, when, you know, I do the Zoom call, it takes me off into sleep. So I probably only hurt about 5-10 minutes.
I had to set an alarm. Yeah, I just fall asleep. So I do it on YouTube. I basically just, if I'm tired in the day and, you know, when you just feel that like total exhaustion, and if I've got a moment, I think, well, I can't go and have a nap because I don't nap in the daytime. It's just not going to work. And, you know, I haven't got time for a whole nap. But if I can find 10, 15 minutes and I'll go and I'll lie down, put a YouTube thing on of yoga nidra and set an alarm because I will fall asleep because it just puts you into such a deep relaxation. But then when that alarm goes off and I kind of rise out of it, it's so different for me. And I'm sure, you know, everyone's experiences are different, so it won't be the same for everybody. But I feel rejuvenated and refreshed after doing that rather than that kind of like sluggish, oh, do I really have to? I fell asleep and now I need to get up. So yeah, I really like it as a little hack of something you can try for like 10, 15 minutes to really just rejuvenate you in your day. But I was also going to ask, how did you feel physically then with this change from kind of being on the precipice of a diabetes diagnosis to making these small changes in your life? How do you feel physically now?
Like I've got new life. Like that sounds really dramatic, but at the time, like I was feeling like bone tired. Like I was feeling bone tired. I was having like joint ache, and I just thought, is this what it's going to be like for the rest of my life now? Like that's gone. Like I don't wake up bone tired. I don't wake up with aches and pains. I have more energy. Like I'm more energized. Sometimes I am tired. We're all tired very often, and that's probably never going to go away. But I feel more energized, but not just physically, I suppose, but mentally and emotionally. Like I feel like I'm much more able to parent better. I'm a nicer mum. I'm a nicer wife.
Yeah.
It just makes me a nicer person when I have prioritized myself. And my well-being and my self-care, and I've taken time out to do that for myself, it just brings me back to being a nicer person. I wrote something down from the book, and it said about taking care of yourself doesn't mean me first, it just means me too. And I was like, I'm not saying my well-being and I, you know, my time out is me and me only. It's just me too. Like everybody deserves to have a little bit of time out for themselves. And that can be really, really difficult when you're parenting a child with disabilities. But what helps that is being open to and accepting of any help and support that you can access. And that might be within your immediate support networks, calling on those. So for me, that's my parents massively. So when they're not here for 4 or 5 months of the year, that's really, really hard. But I recently, you know, I just messaged my brother the other day and I said, look, there are some dates I really, really like for you to be able to have the girl. So me and Tyrone can kind of go and do some stuff together. Would you be able to do these dates? Text back straight away. Yeah, no problem. And it was just that. And old Nicole perhaps would have just been like, oh, well, I just won't do it. And I would just push through. And been really struggling and probably resenting the fact that nobody's asked me if I need any help.
Yeah, but they don't know. Yeah. It's really hard, isn't it, to ask for help? I especially if your coping mechanism is to just do it all. And I don't know about you, but for me it's also about control. I find it quite hard to relinquish control, so it feels like you're not perfect after all, and it's just so important to like dispel that and ask for help. It's interesting you just spoke about a physical reaction to not looking after your wellness, and I suspect there was potentially, you know, there was an emotional contribution to that physical not feeling so well as well. Well, I've always had back problems, and I think back problems are quite common in people in their around my age, early 40s, women in particular, but particularly with kids and kids with disabilities. I think it's like one of the number one complaints physically of carers. And I've always kind of just dealt with it in the when my back's gone, and then like got over it. But 3 months ago, it went again, you know, got a bulging disc, and it wouldn't clear with all the normal things. So I'm actually having a steroid injection on Monday to like a nerve blocker to try and reset, get over the pain. And it's just really like, I feel like that's been a little wake up, like your way back getting your diabetes scare. I feel like that's been a wake up for me in terms of my physical wellness of this thing has always been niggling in the background, but I haven't fully addressed it. I've always been like, oh, it's okay now, and just cracking on. And it's really difficult to flip that and say, actually, I really need to do something fundamental and change my lifestyle and change the way that I approach lifting B and managing kind of my back and my pain in a different way. So yeah, it's really useful to hear this, because this is going to spur me on. This conversation with you, Nicole, is going to actually spur me on.
Yeah, and I think it's so important. And having read those, you know, that book Tender, and just kind of then delving more into, you know, listening to other mums that I'm in contact with, and just, yeah, being more interested in that part of caring, being a carer, and the impact that that can have on your health and your well-being. And again, I was kind of looking back at some of the stuff that I remember kind of reading through in those books a few years back. And in the UK, there's something like 5 million unpaid carers in the UK, like official figures, but actually unofficially they think it's more like over 10 million, right? Mm. And the majority of them, as we've discussed, it's going to be it's us women.
Mm.
Out of that, you know, the majority, like 60%, yeah, have got long-term health conditions or health conditions that they're battling with themselves. And what we know is that, you know, as parents who are caring for children who have got additional needs, we are going through stress, whether that be really noticeable stress or just underlying stress that just ticks over every day. It's just there in the background. And we just get used to living with that level of stress. Has a really, really negative impact. Takes a toll on our bodies. So yeah, you talking about your back, Lauren, like, you know, that niggle there is letting you know that, hey, you're doing too much. Hey, you might need to slow down. Hey, we need to look at
something.
This.
Yeah. Yeah. And is it that physical toil that I guess pain and kind of physical manifestation in people as well? I think it's really important as well to say that's not like the fault of the child in our cases. It's not that the child has done that to you. What has done that to you is kind of, I guess what you said again, the majority of these carers are women. It's almost like the default position of society, and people assume that you will just like devote yourself to raising this child and doing everything you can. Of course you're doing those things, but it's not without cost if you don't also do the and me bit. You need to look after yourself too. So yeah, I think it's I know you have like toyed in with sort of side hustles around well-being outside of the NHS, but in your day-to-day work, do you come into contact with parents with children with disabilities, and do you see a lot of what we've been talking about?
Yeah, so in my day-to-day, you know, many of the children that will access a service that one of the services that my team run, many of them will have additional needs or disabilities. And many of those parents, you know, sometimes in having conversations with them, are struggling with a lot of the things that I've talked about and the things that I've struggled with. And being able to have those conversations with parents in a sort of professional capacity, even though they're sort of opportunistic contact. You know, they may not have come, they've not come for me giving them advice about their well-being. They've come because their child needs to access the service that my team are providing. But it's being able to have those conversations and saying, hey, you know, you're here and this is great that you're doing this for your child, but actually, you know, what else are you doing? What are you doing for you? Because this is really hard. This is really hard. And it's really important to, one, acknowledge that, you know, one of the things that is really important and that I've learned over the last few years is having self-compassion. This is really hard. And like you said, Lauren, it's not the child's fault at all. But it's hard, and it's okay to feel that it's hard. Acknowledging that and kind of being gentle and kind to yourself and taking away those feelings of guilt and shame around those feelings, and then kind of channeling that into it being okay for you to also take time out for yourself.
And say help.
Say help. And asking for help and being honest about how hard you're finding it can open you up to being able to access support. I asked for help from social services. I referred our family for a children and family assessment. It meant that a social worker had to come to our house, which in many families is going to be like a big thing, but definitely within a West Indian household, we don't talk about, you know, things like that, private things. We don't, people come in and ask him personal questions. It's just not the done thing at all. But we had child and family assessment done, and you know, they were able to offer and provide us with respite care for Amber. So she goes to a childcare setting after school a couple of days a week, and during the summer holidays. It means that I have childcare, which, you know, she can't access a typical or mainstream childcare setting. So it means that I have access to that childcare, and that childcare then allows or affords me the ability to work or spend time with Sky or spend time doing something for myself. I have been to put them both into the childcare and just take myself off for the few hours, just to have some time for myself. And that might, again, that might be me just sitting quietly somewhere with a cup of coffee and drinking that really mindfully. It might be me getting my Pilates mat out and doing some Pilates, moving my body. I've also found that that really helps. I didn't get on with the 5K, by the way. I don't do that anymore. That was
You're my kind of woman. I can't see myself running.
So I'm a runner, and I'm the opposite. Oh, okay. I haven't been able to run for 3 months because of my back, which is the longest I haven't run for a long, long time. And the mental toll that has taken on me it's horrible. It's really horrible. So I'm learning to like enjoy walking until I can run again. But yeah, movement, I think, is so key. But I think as well, it's easy to put pressure on ourselves, even in the wellness game, to go, oh, I'm going to do Pilates and I'm going to be all mindful and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. When actually, you know, some of the things that you mentioned right at the start, drink a bit more water in your day. Have 5-10 minutes where you don't have your phone next to you, or you know, it can be really simple things. I love some of those suggestions that you made, and I'm gonna look up that book with some of those hacks, because it is just small things where you can that will make you feel that you're better able to parent, better able to look after yourself, and better able to look after everyone around you. If it's not too big a question, can I just ask about Amber's transition into secondary school? And obviously that comes with a whole kind of new phase. I have a daughter similar age to Amber, who's neurotypical, but that secondary school phase is a big, big change. How has that been? And has that stirred up some of the emotions around kind of going into those default mechanisms of cope, cope, cope? How's it been for you?
I feel her transition into I feel better equipped this time around. So when she was starting primary school, it was just like a completely, you know, she had attended a mainstream nursery, so going into a special school, stirred up all of these sort of emotional feelings about her not attending. You know, again, it's these things that you think about when you're about to have a child or having a child, that they're going to go to this school and da 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 da. It also meant I didn't know anybody that was going to the special primary school that she was going into. So it was complete, it was an unknown. Whereas with high school, it's been an easier transition, I would say. So she's going into a high school with loads of the kids from her primary school. So she's already familiar with she has a lot of friends that are going up already. I think in terms of the transition, Amber's probably handled it way better than me already over summer. I just knew that there were certain things that, as a local authority, were going to be withdrawn from us. So we lost things like transport, which just logistically made things easier to get Amber to the school which she went to before, which was further away from our home. Also meant that my husband could get to work on time, I could get to work on time, I could get Sky to school on time. Oh, that all went out the window. We just had to like rethink about how we do that logistically. And old Nicole would have fallen back into like panic mode. Okay, you know, I've got to push. But instead, you know, I spoke to work and I said, look, this is my situation. How are you gonna, you know, what can we do? And my manager was wonderful and went, right, what we need to do to support you is da-da-da-da. Can we make it more flexible? Do you need to work from home on the days that you need to pick up Amber? I was just able, old Nicole would have just powered through. I wouldn't have said anything to anybody. I just tried to get on with it. But, you know, being able to ask for help, accept the help, and be flexible around that just meant that transition has been easier so far. I am getting a little bit of, I call it preteen attitude from Amber though.
I love a bit of that though. I mean, I don't love it for my own daughter. But yeah, that's hard. It's hard to handle.
100%. So Amber is, like I said before, she has got a lot of speech communication difficulties. I say speech difficulties. Her communication is fine. She lets her needs. She's so she lets us know when she has an issue with certain things. Now a lot of things are no's, they are big no's. that kind of next level of parenting and what that will bring in terms of puberty and adolescence is, again, it's an unknown, but I just feel like whatever, this sounds really like dreamy, this is the dream, whatever life is going to throw at me now, like I just feel like today I can sit here and say, like I just feel like I know that I have got things in my toolkit that I can draw on. I'm not going to default into caffeine and the wine anymore, even though I do still drink the wine and the caffeine, it's just not in the same copious amounts I was before. I know that I can cope, I know that I can manage, and when I can't, when it is really hard, like I can say, hey, this is really hard, I'm going to need some help. And as a family, we're also getting really good at recognizing that in each other. So, you know, if I'm feeling really overwhelmed because, you know, there's the dishes are piling up, the laundry's piling up, I've had to work, I've had to cook meals, and then it just feels like the world, and nobody wants to go to sleep at bedtime so I can sit on the sofa and do nothing. My husband gets in at like 8:30, and then some, you know, sometimes he's really good and he'll go to like Sky and Amber, I think mummy needs a hug.
Oh, sweet.
It's really nice then, because last night again it was one of these moments, and Sky went to me, I think you need a hug, do you need a hug mummy? And I was like, yeah, actually I do. And that, you know, she's seen her dad do that, and she now, you know, it's just a really nice thing. And you know, not to go back to like well-being and self-care, like touch and human touch is one of those things that actually helps to raise our oxytocin levels, and they have really, really positive benefits on our mood and how we feel, but actually also have got really, really positive physical benefits as well.
It's beautiful. Teaching them all that compassion, and it sounds like you're raising two beautiful kids who are gonna be as sorted as you in terms of when one needs a hug and to look after oneself, you know, they know what to do. Oh, that's a lovely way to end it. So thank you so much, Nicole, for coming on The Fucking Normal. I feel like I've learned a lot from you, and I've already started reading Penny Winsor's book since you mentioned it when we spoke recently. So lovely to chat.
Good. been a beautiful conversation, and you've been so eye-opening and has given us some really good advice. So thank you. Greatly appreciated. But to finish, would you mind telling us you're fucking normal?
So thank you for having me. It's been lovely. I've enjoyed it. And my fucking normal is the fact that I drop the balls all the time now, in terms of the juggling, and I'm okay with that. And my, because I'm being greedy, my second fucking normal is taking time out for myself and drawing on my self-care practices. That is fucking normal for me now, whereas before it wasn't.
I love that. Oh
yay, amazing.
Oh, it was so lovely to talk to you. Oh my god, I could talk to you like for hours on end.
Thank you so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We're part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people. You can find more information on this and other episodes at fuckingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fuckingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Wake me up.